Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join this show every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Central, where Bernice Alexander Bennett will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of the guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of the guests. We are in for a treat tonight. Leslie Anderson is a reference librarian in Special Collections Alexandria Library, where she co-authored Alexandria and served as editor of the multi-volume Virginia Slave Births Index, 1853 to 1865. She is on the Board of Governors of the Virginia Genealogical Society, a member of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society, the National Genealogical Society, and several Virginia and Pennsylvania Genealogical Societies. Ms. Anderson received her Master's of Science and Library Science degree from Case Western Reserve University, Cleveland, Ohio, and her Bachelor of Arts degree in American Studies from Wesleyan University, Middletown, Connecticut. She has participated in the Virginia Institute of Genealogical Research, the National Institute on Genealogical Research, the University of Virginia's Rare Book School, Samford University's Institute of Genealogical and Historical Research, and the Genealogical Research Institute of Pittsburgh. Her articles have appeared in the Magazine of Virginia Genealogy and the Virginia Genealogical Society newsletter. Let me give a warm welcome to Leslie Anderson to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi, Natan.
It's great to have you with us this evening. Leslie, let me ask you, how long have you been working as a reference librarian in special collections at the Alexandria, Virginia Library?
I started at Alexandria Library in 2002. So I'm coming up, I've just finished 10 years. In fact, I started there as working part-time as a reference librarian, and when the opportunity was available, I applied for the full-time position and got it. It's been a great experience. It's been really good for me personally and professionally.
That's terrific. What does special collections mean?
There are different types of libraries. All of us are familiar with the ones that we found in the schools that we went to, you know, from K through 12. Those are called school libraries. There are those associated with college and universities. Those are called academic libraries. There are others. I work in a unit called Special Collections, and a Special Collections branch has a specific audience and a specific mission to meet the needs of that audience. And so you will find a Special Collections library in special organizations, nonprofit organizations, and corporate entities. And our mission is to collect, organize, and make available those materials that are related to Alexandria's history, I mean, from its earliest times up until today. And so our holdings relate to family history and genealogy, African-American studies, stories of everyday life, histories of political, military, educational, and business activities, and much more. And if I could make a plug for some numbers, our collection includes nearly 15,000 books and journals, 3,000 rare books, more than 200 maps, 314 different manuscript collections, 3,500 reels of microfilm, and more than 40,000 images and photographs. So you're going to find a lot. You're going to find a lot in Special Collections, and not just about Alexandria, but about the cities and counties in the state and the bordering states.
And what are those bordering states?
Well, they're also the states that were created from Virginia. All roads lead to Virginia, so you've got West Virginia and Kentucky. But we've also got North Carolina, not South Carolina. We've got Maryland, but not Delaware. And when I say we've got the basic indexes and guides to research in those states. We have the historical journals and genealogical journals, the key journals that are associated with those states. And because Alexandria and its environs have been a part of the District of Columbia, we also have genealogical material and historical material related to the District of Columbia.
Wow, that's a lot. So I guess people would be surprised to learn that at Alexandria Library you could find reference material, genealogical, historical materials on North Carolina, for example. But you mentioned something that I wanted to follow up on. You mentioned mm-hmm. Alexandria with the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. Would you give our listeners and chatters sort of historical overview about Alexandria's sort of quirky jurisdictional time, how it bounced back from one jurisdiction to another?
Yeah, quirky is the word. When the newly established republic was in need of a capital, there was lots of discussion about where it should be. There were, of course, political interests who wanted it in Philadelphia. There were political interests who wanted it in New York City. And you may remember that George Washington and a number of the nation's first presidents came from Virginia. They were very powerful men. They were very wealthy men. And so the balance tipped toward this part of the country. When the district was established, the desire was that it would be not subject to other laws of other localities. And so the intent was that it would have its own existence. It would have its own life. Toward that end, Maryland and Virginia both contributed land to form the District of Columbia. And Virginia is just south of the Potomac. And one of the big businesses in the United States at that time was the slave trade. The businessmen in Northern Virginia were very much wanting to keep slavery and the slave trade legal in Virginia. And so there was a push that the land would be returned to the state. There were three attempts. It's called retrocession. And on the third attempt in 1847, that land retroceded to Virginia. A lot of people may not know that Alexandria was a huge port. There were a number of slave jails and slave pens there. There were a number of prosperous merchants and slave traders in the city.
And I guess they, like you said, they were powerful. They didn't want to have to deal with not being able to profit from their business.
And they didn't want to lose their livelihood. That's for sure. Now, they weren't necessarily well-liked or well thought of by the rest of the citizenry, not because of the slave trade itself, but the notion of dealing in human traffic. It's very complex. It's an exercise in human psychology and denial and what we want to believe and what we believe.
Just so our listeners and chatters understand, the time period, I know you mentioned 1847 as the end period where retrocession was successful. If they're looking for ancestors that were in Alexandria, what time period would the records possibly be in the District of Columbia?
Well, it's going to be before that period, but there will also be some overlap. The early D.C. records are at the National Archives. But as any good researcher knows, you want to start from where you are and work backwards. And as a person works carefully, the group of records or the group of individuals, then you will get clues about where to go. And we're there to help you.
Great. Well, you mentioned earlier the volumes of records in the Special Collection, and I'm assuming this area must be pretty large. Could you give our listeners and chatters sort of a verbal tour of what's available there at Special Collections if they happen to visit?
Sure. Well, from the time you enter the building, let me say something about the building that's interesting. The building was constructed in 1938, 1939. By the funds were donated by a wealthy doctor in honor of his mother, Kate Waller Barrett, who was a pioneer. She took herself to medical school. She headed Crittenden Home for unwed mothers, and she was something of a maverick. That building was constructed in 1938, 1939 on a Quaker burial ground. When the building was expanded in the 90s, the remains were removed and reinterred at Woodlawn Cemetery in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. So when you come into the building, it looks fairly small. I mean, the facade of the building is the same as it was at the original structure. But once you enter, it opens up considerably, and that's because of the expansion in the 1990s. So you walk through the first floor of the building, and boom, there we are, Special Collections. They're glass doors. And it looks, it's fairly small. Spacious. It's a study space. On your left, you're going to see shelves and shelves of the some of the 14,000, some of the journals, about 3,000 journals that we subscribe to. And these are not just, they include genealogical titles, but they also include titles like American Archivist, Civil War History, Historic Preservation, the Journal of Southern History, Virginia Tidewater Genealogy. So that's on your left, and then you've got the study tables. Immediately in front of you, you're going to see the map drawers, and they are arranged, let's say for Alexandria, they're arranged chronologically, and the drawers are clearly marked. You know, the more than 200 maps. We've got maps for the other counties and independent cities through Virginia. We've got Sanborn maps, real estate maps. We can come back to that later if you like. Some of these maps are originals. Some of them are reproductions, but they're truly representative of the state. Now over to your right, to your immediate right when you've come in, we've got what some people call a vertical file. And vertical files have come a long way. When I started in this business, vertical files were simply newspaper clippings that were put into folders. And that's not what happens anymore, because people can go online for many newspapers. So what we have in our vertical files are things that are harder to get. They're called gray literature. They're conference proceedings. They are reports. They are brochures. They are arranged alphabetically by subject, and we have an index to those contents, and it's also on our webpage. And once you've made it past the vertical file cabinets, and you see our microfilm printers, we've got three of those, and we've got one that's a scanner, and we've got a PC on that wall. that our public can use, and our stacks are available to the public. They are arranged in the, generally in the Dewey Decimal classification system, and then also within cities and counties. So if you're looking for material, genealogical material on Southampton County, Virginia, then you would go to the S's, you'd work your way through, and you get to Southampton. If you're looking for Richmond and Henrico County, you're going to go to that section as well. And then further back on another wall, we've got our microfilm cabinets and microfiche cabinets. People use them interchangeably, but strictly speaking, they're not the same. Microfilm reels are those tapes, and microfiche cards are the cards that look like big index cards. Oh, and I want to come back to that in a minute, too, because we've got lots of city directories, early city directories, across the United States. There was a corner of reference books and indexes that we call Confederate Corner. And so if you have a Confederate ancestor, if you suspect a Confederate ancestor, that's where you're going to do your key research. We also have on compact shelving our manuscript and archives collection. Now, that area is closed to the public, but we have a means for researchers to sign up to register, and we'll pull the box and the folder for the user. One of the jewels of our space is the Edith Sprouse Rare Book Collection, in which we house original materials, those that are fragile, including our other Sanborn maps, the George Washington Medicinal Dictionary, some original reports and proceedings from the early 18th century. That's it in a nutshell.
Thank you for that tour. You mentioned city directories across the United States, and since we have listeners and chatters who live across the U.S., would you talk more about that?
Sure. Understandably, our emphasis is on Alexandria. And I would dare say we have collected nearly every item that's been published about the city. And that is assigned a designated area. And, of course, we have the business and city directories for Alexandria that we know of. I mean, we have originals and we have photocopies. And those business and city directories go back to 1791. Now, this is not to say we have every year from 1791 to 2013. In fact, we only go up to 1980 on the city directories for Alexandria, and that's because of the leasing arrangement with the publisher. Now, in terms of the city directories for the other locations, on microfiche, we've got, let's see, the company is called, I think it's called, the American Company of Directories. American Directories through 1860, that's what that collection is called. And so from the early 1800s, as early as 1801, through about the 1860s, it doesn't just end at 1860, you can look at city directories from places as varied as Albany, New York, Cincinnati and Zanesville, Ohio, Hartford, Connecticut, New Haven, Louisville, Kentucky, Nashua, New Hampshire, New Bedford, Massachusetts, and Worcester, Massachusetts. Let me say something about that. There was people seeking freedom from the Hampton Roads area in Alexandria often ended up in New Bedford and Worcester, Massachusetts. We've got material on that. So people who have roots in Massachusetts or people drop off the face of the earth in Alexandria might want to also check these directories. You know, and then it continues. I mean, we've got St. Louis, Missouri. We've got New York City and also city directories through upstate New York. But again, this is from the early times, from about 1801 up through, give or take, 1860. And people have found some good results there.
It sounds like that when people come to Washington, D.C. to visit the National Archives, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Library of Congress, they should also add to their list special collections at the Alexandria Library. Sounds like you have a wealth of resources there.
Well, we think so. And any time you're trying to keep this type of thing going in these economic times, it's a challenge. And again, there are public libraries throughout the country. You have to decide, well, what's your mission? And so rather than try to go broad, you know, rather than seek to collect materials on the other states that merit it, you know, such as Florida, Ohio, Delaware, as I mentioned before, we go deep on Virginia. Many times people come to our library having come from those other places and they say, I wish I had started here. And so I would very much encourage people to come visit us. Parking might be a problem, but once you get in, you'll be really glad you came.
You mentioned, Leslie, a Confederate corner at the Special Collections, and I just thought about it. What was Alexandria's role during the Civil War?
Oh, it was unusual.
In what way?
In May 18, well, Sumter was fired on, Fort Sumter fired on in the spring of 1861. And in May, federal troops came across the Long Bridge from D.C. directly into Alexandria. The city was occupied for the entire period of the war. And so the experience there of the residents and the military was a little different. People came there. I mean, New York 71st Regiment was there for a great period of time. Some people blamed them for taking away a lot of the records from the courthouse, but, you know, that's debatable. But there were things that happened. There was interchange that took root during that period that followed through after the war. Now, as it turns out, we also have in our collection a number of items specific to Alexandria that also give a hint of what Civil War life was like in a small urban area, in a southern town, a town that had been a very successful seaport. So we've got titles in our collection related to that era. For example, the Inspector of Prisons was Captain Rufus Dudley Pettit, not known for his humane outlook on people. We have photocopies of his papers there. We also have a monograph prepared by a local historian called Volunteers for Freedom, Black Civil War Soldiers in Alexandria National Cemetery. That monograph also has a companion website, webpage that is accessible through our website. We've got books, theses, dissertations with titles like The Alexandria Waterfront in Wartime, Military Occupation and Cultural Perceptions, Union Soldiers in Alexandria, Virginia, 1861 and 1865. So you're going to get some names, too. And it may or may not be your ancestor. The larger point is that you're gaining significant historical context that gives your research meaning and gives your findings a robustness that you're not going to find if you're only following the records, if you're only climbing the tree. It's like if you want the family history, then you want to know about the community. And I guess the next question would be, well, what about the African-American presence in the city? Well, it was a seaport town. You've got a lot of activity. I mean, this is true before the Civil War, and it was true afterwards. So you've got African-Americans involved in every possible occupation, and certainly with the advent of the Civil War, freedom seekers came to Washington, D.C., and many of them landed in Alexandria. There's lots of military activity. You've got the railroad. It's a point of distribution for ordnance, for supplies, for wagons. You've got African-American men and women engaged in occupations associated with the railroad, associated with the wharves, with lodging. And so we're going to have titles in our collection that might be of interest to you called, you know, A Look at the African-American Community Through Alexandria's Eyes, 1780 to 1810, Free Black Adaptive Responses to the Antebellum Urban Environment, 1790 to 1850, A Peculiar Business, slave trading in Alexandria, Virginia, 1825 to 1861. The Alexandria Slave Pen, the archaeology of urban captivity. Moving into the 20th century, we've got a ton of material on desegregation in Alexandria public schools, education in the city from 1900 to 1964. We've got a compendium, and now this is where we've got a compendium of early African Americans in Alexandria, Virginia, archaeology in an Afro-American neighborhood, 1830 to 1910. So again, you're going to get names, you're going to get addresses, you're going to get details, and you're going to get context.
That's great, and that's great information that someone could possibly accumulate on their ancestors or the community they lived in. There are a few questions coming out of the chat, so I'd like to read those to you. The first question is, does the library have information on the former Virginia counties that are now West Virginia, like Jefferson County?
Oh, yeah. The let me give you the reference desk number. It's 703-746-1791. Call us, any one of us at the reference desk will be happy to help you. And you also want to visit our website, which has a fairly lengthy address. I'll be happy to give it to you. It's www.alexandria.lib.va.us. Once the page has loaded, you want to go to the frame on the left for location. You want to hit the drop-down box, and you want to go to Special Collections. And from there, on our page, you're going to find links to online indexes and guides, links to our online exhibits, and other useful materials that will help you prepare for your visit to us.
Great. Thank you for sharing that information. Another question, what county did Alexandria come from, or was it always Alexandria?
No. Originally, when Virginia was established in the 1600s, it was eight shires. Were created. These are what we would refer to as counties. And through those years, one of the original counties that came from that period was Fairfax County. Through a series of boundary changes, jurisdictions, you know, then we were known as Arlington County, and then there's the city and the town of Alexandria. That can get really messy, you know, as is the case with any extant and then extinct counties. And so we also collect deeply in Fairfax County material. I would say we have nearly as much material on Fairfax County as we do on Alexandria proper because of that phenomena.
Thank you. One other question before we go to break. Question is, working at the library, what has been the most interesting or unique thing or things that you have come across?
I'd have to think about that. Maybe we can come back to that after the break. Because every day is different.
This is a great time to take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is the guest host, Nakani Lane Kemp, and you are listening to Leslie Anderson, Reference Librarian and Special Collections of the Alexandria Library. I want to remind everyone that all of these shows are archived and available immediately after broadcast as a podcast. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. Leslie, have you had a chance to think of an answer to that question?
Well, yeah. Let me think of the one that I can share with you, because while we handle questions, and some of them might seem off the wall to another researcher or to a professional librarian, there is a part of the ethics of our profession is confidentiality. And so if a person should come in and say, I am looking to prove that this property belonged to this family during this period of time because of a legal dispute, we would do our best to help that person. A few hours later, if an individual from the other side of the question comes in, then we treat that question in the same way. There is no reason for us, and it would be entirely inappropriate for us to share with that individual what the other individual asked. And I think that might be an extreme example, but that's the basis for what we do. And so I hesitate to call on specifics, but I will share with you the type of question that we've gotten more than once. And so it's kind of like the census taker. Don't want to be able to identify anybody, but on more than one occasion, we've had a patron come in and say, I've done my genealogy, I've been working on it for 20 years and 30 years, but last night I found that I'm a direct descendant of John the Baptist. Well, there's a whole lot going on in there. You know, we've had people who are sure they are direct descendants of Charlemagne, or they are a direct descendant of George Washington or whomever, and we treat that person and their request respectfully. You know, we do a reference interview. Where did you look? What have you found? And what is it you'd like to leave here with? And that often helps people focus. So if a person comes in and says, I need a birth certificate from Virginia, 1850. Well, you're not going to find it because the state did not gather birth certificates at that time. If you lived in an independent city like Richmond or Lynchburg or Norfolk, well, maybe. What you're looking for, I want a birth certificate from such and such a time. What you want is a documentation of a person's birth. And that documentation may come from an item that looks nothing like a birth certificate. And so we have to think about our role as reference librarians is to determine very quickly and accurately, what is it that the patron is looking for? And how can we help them get there and help them get themselves there so that they can continue?
There is a question that's coming out of the chat that I want to read to you. Were there any underground railroad routes through Alexandria?
My understanding is that there have been documented locations. There is an activity called, I think it's called the Underground Freedom Network. And for this part of the country, for the Eastern Seaboard, the coordinator is Jenny Mazur.
Would you repeat that name, please?
Jenny Mazur, M-A-S-U-R. And that's a part of their mission to document Underground Railroad sites. Now, you can be assured that because of the port activity, seaports were are known. I mean, we know that a number of people fled bondage through the waterways, through the rivers, through the tributaries, that people who lived there, African Americans and whites, who lived in those communities, who knew the terrain, assisted other people in fleeing slavery. At the moment, I can't think of a particular site, but when I'm in the office tomorrow, I'll check.
Okay, great. And one of our chatters has asked, again, would you please identify the organization and the name? She got Jenny,
mm-hmm.
but if you repeat mm-hmm. that one more time.
I believe it's the Underground Freedom Network. But if you Google Jenny's name, that's J-E-N-N-Y, the surname M-A-S-U-R. Put that in quotes, in all lowercase, two words, in quotes, and her name will pop up. And that is an activity that she and her colleagues are engaged in, not just on the Eastern Seaboard, not just in the South, but also in the Midwest.
Great, thank you. Now, I would
mm-hmm.
be remiss if I didn't discuss with you, you being the editor of the multi-volume Virginia Slave Birth Index, 1853 to 1865, could you
mm-hmm.
enlighten us all about that index?
Okay. As background, if you're a serious researcher, if you're not just grabbing names and dates, in addition to knowing about the history of a place, you want to know something about the law of the place, because that's going to take you to the records that you're seeking. First, you're going to find out if those types of records exist. And one of the things that the Commonwealth did, that the state of Virginia did, as a lot of states did in the mid-19th century, was to gather public health information. When were people born? When were people dying? And so the state of Virginia, the legislator, enacted a law that required the collection of birth information throughout the state. That commenced in 1853, and that information was recorded on registers, the ledgers, those larger volumes that we've handled. During the Roosevelt administration, the Depression years, people were put to work on various projects. The Work Project Administration, the WPA, was engaged in an indexing project for the slave birth, for the birth index associated with Virginia. Those registers have been microfilmed. The original registers are at the Library of Virginia. The indexes on typescript are on microfilm, also at the Library of Virginia. But they're hard to read. They're hard to read, and it's hard to use them. So early in my career at Alexandria Library, I went to a lecture by my colleague, Char McCargo-Barr, and Char mentioned the Slave Birth Index. And I said to my manager when I got back to work, I said, we've got to get this microfilm. And when we got the microfilm, we found that it was very difficult to read, and so I put together a proposal to her. How about we enter this data from the microfilm, from the index, and deliver it to our public in a publication. And so with the staff, nearly all the staff at Special Collections and some of our specially trained volunteers, that's what we did. And so after 4 years, many CDs, many floppy disks later, we produced the index. And it's arranged alphabetically by the informant, the person reporting the birth, who is often the slave owner, but not always. Sometimes the informant is an overseer or it's a neighbor, because these births were to be recorded at the courthouse. There was a penalty if you did not record births. And you've also got the infant's name when it's available. You've got the name of the mother when it's available. You've got the birth date. Sometimes in the column for birth date, you're only going to find a year. Sometimes you'll find a season, spring, 1858. Sometimes you'll get a month, May, 1860. Sometimes you'll get what's reported to be an exact date. There's information on whether or not the birth involved twins or stillbirth. Sometimes there is a last name associated with the mother or with the infant. You also get the place of birth. So with those five volumes, it is a starting point that index takes the reader to the registrar. Some people stop with the index, and that's a good thing. It's a step, but it shouldn't be the end point. Once you've looked at the index and then take it to the next level and look at the register, the birth register, which is on microfilm and available through interlibrary loan from your home library. So let's suppose if you're a resident of Silver Spring, Maryland, you can request, you can go to your regional library, your library down the street in Montgomery County, and you can request that microfilm. There's generally a nominal fee, about $5, depending on the library system, and that microfilm will come to you at your home library. Your home library meaning where you're a resident.
And that's great, because not every library system will allow such interlibrary loans. So that's
well,
great.
Well, and there have to be, I mean, there are costs involved. You know, the figures in the profession said that it costs a library system between $15 and $25 to do an interlibrary loan from beginning to end. So if a patron is paying $5 to get the microfilm, they are bearing only a portion of the cost, and it's well worth it. Because very often, I'm sorry, very often on that register, you're going to see additional notes that are not picked up in our index or in any other kind of index that you're dealing with in your research.
You mentioned that the Virginia Slave Birth Index is arranged alphabetically by the informant. What if someone has the name of an ancestor who was born during this time period, may know the name of the mother, but have no idea of the slave owner or the informant, but they know the county or the city where the ancestor was born?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you asked that. We recognize that was going to be a situation of some of our users. And in fact, we debated whether or not to make the index available alphabetically by informant or to do it by locality. At the time, published in 2007, we started 2003. At the time, in about 2003, our impression was that at the time, people were looking by surname. That has since changed for a lot of reasons. People are doing deeper research, that more technology is available, more online information is available, there's more exchange, and more frequently now, we've got people coming in and saying, well, I know what the county was. And toward that end, we are preparing a geographic supplement that we expect to publish by the end of the year. And so our five volumes includes 130,000 plus entries. Some of those volumes go up to about 500 pages. That's a pretty hefty weight. Our geographic supplement, also published by Heritage Books, will have a different organization. So it will include, it will list alphabetically the counties and the independent cities. Let's start with Accomack. And then it's going to list the surnames of informants in that city. So you're going to have Adams, Baker, Coleman, and so on. Now, let's suppose there were 10 different Colemans who reported slave birth. Coleman, that name Coleman will only appear once, because what the idea is that you know who the informant was geographically. And so we're working our way through that publication. And we expect that to be one volume, probably about 200 pages.
Well, I think for those researchers who don't know the informant or the slave owner, this will be extremely beneficial. I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about the book Alexandria.
Yeah, that was an adventure. We a lot of people might be familiar with Arcadia Press, the publisher does soft cover books, local histories, and they have several series. I think probably their most widely known series is Images of America, which features a community or an activity, a city or a county. And we were approached by the publisher to do this book. And we followed their guidelines. We identified more than 200 photographs, probably more like 300. And the three of us, the manager of Special Collections Branch, George Combs, the images librarian, Julie Downey, and I worked together to do this publication. And so we've got introductory chapters. We've got four chapters that are broken down chronologically that cover Alexandria's inception from the Paleo-Indian days, you know, 13,000 years ago, up till the early 21st century. And so it's very visual. It's very, very attractive. You're going to find photographs in there that I think you're not going to find elsewhere. We wanted to, our intent was to be accurate, to be educational, and we document it. You know, this was no shoot from the hip text writing. We know what we know, and we wanted to make sure that we could support what we were writing. I think what pleases me most about the book is the cover image. It is it's a wonderful photograph that was brought to our attention a few months before we finished the manuscript. And it shows a group of people in front of a house. It's a double house that stands in Alexandria. And there's this group of people on the steps and on the sidewalk. There are blacks and whites. There are men and women. There are children, boys and girls. There are civilians and military. And it appears that these individuals were associated, our evidence suggests that these individuals were associated with the Freedmen's Bureau school that was active in Alexandria during that time, and that this was a commemorative event, perhaps a celebration. And it's a very powerful image because it speaks to what the city was experiencing at that time. It's representative of the community. I mean, there are people in here who are well-dressed and some not so well-dressed. You know, off to the side, there's a horse and the saddle. And it's really quite moving.
Speaking of Alexandria's post-Civil War history, anything significant in terms of African Americans in Alexandria in that post-Civil War period? Were there any sit-ins in Alexandria?
Oh, yeah.
And how early did one occur?
Well, perhaps one of the earliest sit-ins in the country took place in my library, in our building, the one that was built on the creek, the burial ground, in 1939. At that time, there was just one library building in the city, and African-American citizens could not get a library card. The custom and tradition was whites only. A young attorney named Samuel Tucker lived just a few blocks from the building. And Samuel Tucker, native Alexandrian, wanted to become an attorney but could not afford to attend the nearby law school at Howard University. And so what he did was to read for the law with an established attorney, and that is still an option these days in the Commonwealth. Mr. Tucker read for the law, took the bar exam, and passed. the first time, but he had to wait a year to be sworn in because he wasn't quite 21 years old. He'd had some experiences in his youth with segregation, one of them. He and a companion were told to get off a streetcar because of where they had chosen to sit. And so the idea of citizens not being able to have access to the services that they were paying taxes for, from a legal standpoint, you know, and a moral standpoint, deeply disturbed him. And so he devised a plan, and he trained several young men, young African-American men, in an act of civil disobedience. And what happened was the plan for that day was that each young man would enter the library on Queen Street, ask for a library card. They were refused. Then the young man would take a book from the shelf, sit at the table, and read. An hour later, another young man repeated those actions. Within a few hours, there were five African-American young men, well-dressed, reading quietly. The librarian on premise called the police. The police came and arrested them, but were confused about what charges to bring. They hadn't broken any law, and so they were arrested with charges of disorderly conduct. In the meantime, there had been a lookout, and this young man ran to Mr. Tucker's office to let him know what was happening. That was also part of the plan. Mr. Tucker met the young men at the police station. And this was big. This was huge. This was picked up in the African-American press. It was followed closely by the New York Age, by the newspapers in Atlanta, I mean, the Pittsburgh Courier, of course. This was a big deal. It went to court. The city's solution was to stall. And Mr. Tucker would accept no less than complete access. He fell ill. During that time, leaders in the community of Alexandria acquiesced and agreed to a segregated facility. That building was constructed very quickly. A black librarian was hired. She was a graduate of Hampton Institute. When Mr. Tucker recovered, he was infuriated. He wrote a letter to the librarian of Alexandria Library and said he would never apply for, he would never accept a library card from a segregated library. We have that original letter in our collection.
Wow.
Now, that event was resolved in about August, September. That was when it peaked. But when it happened that the building was being constructed for African Americans, it was overshadowed by some events happening in Europe. And what had happened was that Hitler invaded Poland. And so a lot of people don't know about that event. We do have a plaque in the foyer of our building that explains this act of civil disobedience and commemorates the event and honors those individuals. And about 3 years ago, we had a reenactment of the event that involved elementary school students from Samuel Tucker Elementary School.
Wonderful.
Attended by city council members and members of our library board.
Leslie, any closing remarks or suggestions for individuals coming to visit your library, or any general closing remarks?
I suppose when you're visiting a library or repository, call. Call first to make sure that we're open. We are open. We're now open every Saturday, but we are closed to the public all day on Thursday. We're back there working, but we're not able to accommodate visitors on Thursday. But then there are some basic things. When you come to a library, don't start photocopying in the last half hour. You know, the machine could jam. It could overheat. There could be a stampede toward the photocopier. You know, when you are talking to a reference librarian, to someone on the staff, be very clear on what you want and try to avoid what I call the baguettes. You know, a baguette is something like my grandmother's half-sister, had an uncle who moved from Maryland to D.C., and I'm trying to get their best friend's obituary. You know, come in, and we get caught up in that because we're passionate about what we're looking for. And I have to be careful of that myself when I'm going to another place. But try to stay focused on what it is you're looking for, and then we can tease out the background later. And please know a couple things about libraries in these times. One is that there's a reason that things aren't digitized. Some items are too fragile, and digitization is an expensive process. And if libraries are struggling to keep staffing up and keep the doors open, we can't get our materials digitized. We might be able to get them indexed, and that might be it. And I think probably the most important thing for a person visiting a library is that the things that make you unhappy are the same things that make us unhappy. You know, we want to have an index to this or to that. We want something to be every name searchable. So I think together we can muddle through to the answers that you're seeking, and we will do our best, and I can guarantee you we won't make anything up.
Well, thanks so much. Those are great tips. I'd like to inform everybody about what's coming up next week. Bernice returns next Thursday, April 18th. The guest will be Marvin Jones, and he will be discussing family and community history of the Winton Triangle, the 400-plus-year-old history of the land-owning triracial people of color in an area centered in Hertford County, North Carolina. Good night, everyone, and remember, your ancestors left footprints, therefore you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. You can continue this discussion on Afrogenius.com and the research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. Don't forget to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton-Raji on Friday morning. And remember to join Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is the guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. Leslie, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Good night, everyone, and please join Bernice next Thursday.